Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 9th of February. Our guest this hour, his latest book is Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. Gary Wills is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of 40 books, including Lincoln at Gettysburg, Cincinnatus, George Washington and the Enlightenment, What Jesus Meant, Head and Heart, St. Augustine, Why I Am a Catholic, and many other books. This particular book, he says in the first sentence, has a basic thesis, and that's that the bomb altered our subsequent history down to its deepest constitutional roots. It redefined the presidency as, in all respects, America's commander-in-chief, a term that took on a new and unconstitutional meaning in this period. It fostered an anxiety of continuing crisis so that society was pervasively militarized. It redefined the government as a national security state with an apparatus of secrecy and executive control, and it redefined Congress, as an executor of the executive. Gary Wills is professor of history emeritus at Northwestern University, is a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books. He is a former Jesuit seminarian. He reads Latin and Greek, and he is trained as a classicist. The book about the 37th president landed him on the infamous enemies list. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for this discussion, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Gary Wills, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I was amazed to read, I've known the outline of the story, but the incredible secrecy surrounding the building of the atomic bomb, even though thousands of people were involved, nobody knew.
That's right. Even Senator Truman, when he was a senator, who investigated the expenditure of government money during the war, never caught on that billions were being spent, unauthorized, channeled through fake conduits. And even when he became vice president, he didn't know anything about the bomb. It was not until President Roosevelt's death, when he assumed the presidency, that he was finally informed that this bomb was being developed.
And there was a whole enclave built with some 3,500 people, I believe you're right, and scientists brought their children, because who would want to go out into the desert without your family to work on a project that may take years? Just a huge number of people involved to build this, but very few people in government knowing about it.
That's right, and even the people in the at Los Alamos, unless they were top physicists, didn't know what was going on. I have a friend who grew up as a little girl at Los Alamos.
Really?
She was 7 and 8 years old at the time. She had no idea what her father was doing, and she claims her mother didn't know either. Although there were local workers who came in to do maintenance and that kind of thing, there were three encircling fences, and the innermost, only the physicists were allowed in, and even they had to speak code language. They never referred to the bomb. It was the gadget. They never referred to themselves as physicists. They had to take an assumed names when they went there. And at the end of the day, they would wipe the blackboards clean and stow all the papers in safes. So there was secrecy within secrecy. And there are two other main locations, Hanford and Oak Ridge, developing plutonium and uranium, respectively. And there were 80 other locales, universities, corporations, which worked on some aspect of the bomb without knowing what they were working on. There was a secret Air Force base. There was a secret test site at Alamogordo. There was a secret takeoff place in the Pacific, Tinian Island. All of this was arranged by one man, General Leslie Groves, who was given dictatorial power, so much so that he not only spied on Americans, but spied on foreigners, and he sent a man out to assassinate Werner Heisenberg for fear that he had secrets that the Germans could use for the building of a bomb.
Hmm.
So we have never had that kind of authority. And the interesting thing is that all kinds of laws were being broken. No accountability to Congress, unauthorized monies, secret commandeering of resources. And at the end of the war, in other cases, when emergency powers have been granted, they are taken away when the emergency expires. So although there are crimes committed during wartime, the suspension of habeas corpus during Civil War and the interning of Japanese Americans during World War II, both of those are declared unconstitutional after the war is over, and we return to our non-emergency status. That didn't happen with the bomb. It remained the great big secret we had to protect and develop and perfect and test and deploy. And there was one man in charge of that, as there had been at Los Alamos. Then it was Leslie Groves. Now it became President Truman. Truman was granted a power no other president had ever had, that he alone, no one else, with no oversight, no congressional approval needed, could launch a nuclear attack. The rationale for that was that in the nuclear era, if we were in danger of a nuclear attack, if it was impending or occurring, the response would have to be instantaneous, either to anticipate or to retaliate, and there would be no time to talk it over. So all of this power was given to the president. But that became the basis of a whole series of other powers. In order to guard the secrets and deploy the bomb, special agencies were created, the NSC, the NSA, the CIA, all with their own codes of secrecy, of classification, of clearance. And when Truman went to war in Korea, Secretary of State Dean Acheson said, "This is not a nuclear war, so technically you don't have the power to initiate it on your own. But to protect your power to initiate war, don't even ask Congress for any kind of approval of war in Korea." And from that moment on, there has never been a congressional declaration of war in the whole post-World War II era. The president starts them on his own initiative. And even the War Powers Act, when Congress tried to get back into some kind of control, has been routinely ignored since it was passed.
And Truman, I didn't realize this, that the bomb was under active consideration in the Korean War.
That's right. And the people who urged it also came back to urge a preemptive strike against China's nuclear establishment. So it's been around as an option. President Truman said at the time, "It's a weapon. We developed it. If we want to use it, we can use it." So there's a kind of emergency crisis atmosphere that Truman cultivated. In fact, he didn't want to demobilize the armed forces after the war. He wanted to have universal military training so that the nation would be ready to go to war at any minute. He also said that because of the national emergency, railway workers, when they went on strike, could be drafted into the army. And when the Korean War was going on and there was labor unrest in the steel industry, he seized the steel mills. The Supreme Court took that away from him. But that sense of a continuing emergency became the atmosphere in which the government operated. When he wanted to give aid to Greece, even though a lot of people were opposed because those Greek people had collaborated with the fascists, he brought in Senator Vandenberg of Michigan, a Republican he had worked with before, and he wanted a bipartisan support. And what Vandenberg told him, if you want to do this, you've got to scare hell out of the country.
Right.
And that's what he did. The Truman Doctrine said that anywhere democracy is threatened, which meant in the code of the time, anywhere where communists could take over, we have to intervene. And that scared some people so much that a veteran of World War II said, "I went up and tried on my uniform to see if it still fit."
Was it because, let me ask a multi-part question here. Was it because of the nature of Truman's presidency, if he had thought more about the use of the bomb in Japan, as many of the scientists were, because they thought it was to be used for Germany. If he had been much more concerned about the ramifications of the dropping of such a bomb, do you think that subsequent presidents would have acted differently when it came to the Bay of Pigs, when it came to Kuwait, when it came to Vietnam?
Yes, I think so, because, as I say, the cult of the presidency led to all of these agencies that were used in later operations and wouldn't have come into existence but for the bomb. Whether he would have had any doubts about using it, he said no. He never regretted, said he gave it no thought. And although some scientists were opposed, especially to the development of the hydrogen bomb, very few of them really objected to the dropping of the bombs on Japan. Later theories were that we could have done a demonstration drop out in the ocean. The trouble with that, Robert Oppenheimer himself said, we don't know yet what the real capacity of this bomb is, because we've only tested it on the ground in a tower with ideal conditions. We're not flying a plane through aircraft fire, and we're not dealing with weather conditions or with the mechanics of the bomb site and the bomb bays. So what if we announced that we had this great big horrible weapon and we dropped it and it wasn't so horrible after all? We'd be in worse case, and we would look rather silly when the secret came out of all the manpower, all the talent, all the money, all the resources we've put into this. And he wanted rather to drop it, the two bombs. By the way, the authorization was not bomb by bomb. Truman authorized the dropping of two bombs. It was a package deal. We dropped all we had. And the second one was supposed to be worse than the first, so that we would give the impression of an escalation of threats. Actually, it turned out to be less destructive because the weather conditions made it, the plane drop it slightly off target, and hills contained some of the blast, so it was actually not as big a blast as Hiroshima had been. But there was never any consideration of dropping just one and seeing what the reaction of the Japanese would be. Oppenheimer wanted to drop them both on the same day on two different cities to make an overwhelming demonstration. And if one didn't work, the other one probably would. And General Groves said, no, we've got to drop one to see if anything goes wrong and correct it when we drop the next one. So there was never any consideration of not dropping them right away. And as a matter of fact, they were scared. If it came out, well, they knew it would come out when they broke up the secret compounds and the physicists went back to their universities. Then, even if we had not dropped the bomb, it would become known that we had it. And if there had been an invasion of Japan, although General MacArthur and General Eisenhower both said it was unnecessary because the blockade of Japan and the firebombings were bringing the country to its knees without an invasion. Nonetheless, if an invasion had occurred or any kind of deaths of Americans by suicide, kamikaze attacks or whatever, and it turned out that we had the bomb and didn't use it, you can imagine what the families of the killed American military people would be. And so Groves hired the science writer from the New York Times to come and be secretly prepared to propagandize for the weapon as soon as it came out, because he didn't want a reaction of anger from Congress that they had been bypassed, or of the populace that this thing had occurred without their knowing that it was being done on their behalf. Mm-hmm. So, as I say, if they had not used it and there had been American deaths, the reaction would have been overwhelmingly negative, so much so that the president could have been impeached and Groves could have been court-martialed. That's the kind of fear they were operating from.
So that's what you mean when you say President Truman could not use the bomb.
That's right. Once they had it, they had to use it. And that's the kind of entrapment that these Frankenstein monster weapons create.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls for you, and we'll do that in just one moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Gary Wills. He is the author of a number of very important books. His latest is Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Gary Wills and start with John from Green Bay. Hi, John.
Oh, yes. Hello there. Earlier in the show, you talked about how the development of the bomb really began the eroding of our constitutional rights. And I think it's pretty clear today that it's been a downward escalation or a spiral ever since. I'd like to... You mentioned that there was so much secrecy and subterfuge that went into the development of this bomb, and that thousands of people were involved, yet nobody knew about it. And there are those of us who believe that there are many unanswered questions surrounding the 9/11 attacks. And whenever I bring this up to somebody, they say, well, how could something so elaborate be kept such a secret? I'd like to hear what Mr. Wills has to say about that.
Okay. Professor Wills?
Well, I don't see any parallel. After all, it was our government protecting our secret. Now, to blow up our property in the name of our people doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of conspiracy theory that claimed that Pearl Harbor was engineered by President Roosevelt and that the assassination of John F. Kennedy was run by the CIA. All those kinds of conspiracy theories don't make any sense. And the people who acted at Los Alamos and Hanford and Oak Ridge and the other sites were patriots. They were outstanding physicists and other people. And after all, the secret was shared by President Roosevelt's little panel. He appointed a panel to bypass not only the Congress, but the military chain of command. It was General Groves' superiors did not give him his orders. He got his orders directly from Conant and other people on this secret panel that President Roosevelt had set up. So they were acting in good faith. They thought that the Germans were developing a bomb. They had to develop one first. And they took a big gamble. Many at the beginning thought it couldn't be done, and certainly couldn't be done within 2.5 years as they finally did it. So the secrecy had a totally different rationale, and those who kept it thought that they were operating in a patriotic way to counter the Germans. So there was nothing wrong with what they did. And as I say, in a war, emergency powers are routinely given. But they're normally taken away afterward. In this case, that didn't happen in this case. The secrecy and the development of the bomb into even the hydrogen bomb continued at a greater rate. More secrets are classified. Clearances got harder to get. Secret bases were set up. Remember, the president now had not only to develop and protect the bomb, but to deploy it. Originally, that was the Strategic Air Command that put bombs up in the sky flying around the clock. And they needed bases, they needed refueling, they needed various kinds of services around the world. And the same thing happened when we started sending out submarines with nuclear weapons and then intercontinental ballistic missiles. So all of that led to a worldwide, largely secret network of things connected with servicing the bomb.
Mm-hmm. And it becomes part of so many other administrations. I love this sentence you have in your chapter when you're dealing with the Cuban Missile crisis and all that happened in the Kennedy administration here, that the trouble with protecting secrets is that new forms of secrecy have to be invented to guard the original ones.
That's right. There's layer on layer on layer.
Right.
And there has to be a lot of public lying about it. For instance, Fidel Castro accepted the Russian missiles, even though at first he didn't want them, because why would he want that little island to be the center of a nuclear war? It would evaporate. And nonetheless, when he found out, as he quickly did, that the Kennedys were trying to assassinate him, sabotage his crops, mine his harbors, he decided that that was a prelude to an invasion by America. And he knew he couldn't withstand that with his own armed force. So the only deterrent he thought he could have would be to accept the Russian missiles. Now, when President Kennedy got up and said, there is no conceivable defensive use of these weapons, they're purely offensive, so they're clearly meant to start an attack on us, he was lying, because there was a defensive rationale. The fact that he was trying to stave off all these attacks that were being made on him by the Kennedy administration.
Let's go next to Rich from Sullivan. Hi, Rich. How are you?
I'm okay, Kathleen.
Good
morning.
Good morning.
Everything I'm hearing Mr. Wills say strikes me as basically true. I thank him for the comment on Vandenberg promising Truman that he could have what he wanted if he scared the hell out of the American people. In 1950, Albert Einstein said, the men who possess the real power in our country have no intention of ending the Cold War, and on and on and on it goes. We know about this, and we also know that in September 1985, our Commerce Department told us for the first time we had become a debtor, not a creditor nation, in the modern era at least. And that's where we are today. What bothers me, because we have Mr. Wills, Gore Vidal, Naomi Klein with her book, The Shock Doctrine, and so on and so forth, is not that we as a nation, I mean, it is that we as a nation have sort of given up on the founders' idea of true Republican values, because industrially, where are we most powerful now? Not in non-war materials, but in the industries that are devoted to war. Our supposedly patriotic corporate executives have chased cheap labor around the world for making cars and electronics and other kinds of things over 30 or 40 years. And I know firsthand that the militarized industries are very profitable, because I have a nephew in his 40s who just got a job at a major airplane company, let's put it that way, which will go unnamed, and he starts at six figures easily. Mm. But he also tells me, his uncle, Uncle Rich, they're a bunch of soulless executives. I'm working for the military-industrial complex now.
Yeah, I had a brother-in-law who did that, too. Hmm. Well, yeah, what you bring up about the militarization of the country is very important. The commander-in-chief title has taken off. Its original use was comparatively modest. It came from the British. When they had several admirals in the same theater of the ocean, and they had competing authorities, the government said, Admiral so-and-so will be commander-in-chief. It was a title temporary and geographically restrained. He'd be commander-in-chief for the time he was there in that part of the ocean. And it didn't change his basic office. He was still an admiral when he stopped being commander-in-chief, as he had been before. So when General Washington was sent to Boston, there were militia generals and other competing authorities, and the Congress said, you're going to be the commander-in-chief. Now, when the Constitution was set up, it was said that the president would be commander-in-chief of the military. And that was at a time when they were not envisaging a standing army in peacetime. So the military at war, he will be the commander-in-chief. And of the militias when they are called into national service. So he's not even the commander-in-chief of the National Guard unless they get federalized. But now we talk about our commander-in-chief. He's the commander-in-chief of the citizenry. I ran a op-ed piece in the New York Times saying constitutionally, whatever else he is, the president is not my commander-in-chief. I got the most angry letter saying, if he's not your commander-in-chief, you're not a citizen. Get out of this country. So the definition of citizenship now is that we obey our commander-in-chief. Another sign of that is the fact that since President Reagan, when a president gets off the airplane or the helicopter, he's saluted, and he salutes back. That's against all military procedure. The salute is for the uniform. Even a general out of uniform is not saluted. The president is not a military officer. That was proved in a court case when part of the estate of George Washington was in New York, and some of his heirs there said that Dutchess County gives a tax break to veterans, and so they should get a tax break as somebody related to George Washington. That went to court, and the court said, it's true he was a military officer, but that was before the Constitution occurred. The Continental Congress paid him as a military person, and then he retired, and that was the end of that. But he's not a military person now. The president is not. He's not paid by the military. He's not pensioned by the military. He can't be court-martialed as every other military officer can. He is a civilian who is the head of the army in wartime, and that's a unique situation that the Constitution set up. And we used to be proud of that we had civilian control of our military. But now he's treated as a military person. He's saluted. He's called the commander-in-chief, not only of the military, but of the citizenry. In fact, if you remember, when President Nixon wanted to fire Archibald Cox, the independent counsel in the Watergate investigation, he told his staff person, General Haig, to call up the Attorney General and say, fire Archibald Cox. And he said, I can't do that. Congress didn't set this office up for that to occur. And so then Haig went to the deputy at the Justice Department, Rumsfeld, and he said, fire Archibald Cox. He said, no, I can't do that. And he said, your commander-in-chief has given you an order. You must obey. Well, Rumsfeld was a civilian. The president was not his commander-in-chief. But we have now so aggrandized the president's military power, creeping of this into other areas of our life goes on slowly but surely over decades.
Mm-hmm. You had something else, Rich?
I just wanted to say, I think it's the acceptance by the vast majority of the American people that so frightens me. And Mr. Will's example of writing an intelligent, well-reasoned commentary on our society is met with what amounts to hate mail, saying, and I believe him, that people would say, as they sort of insinuated about Albert Einstein, when he said in the 1950s, these people have no intention of ending the Cold War, meaning, subtextually, it's very profitable for them. The American people have accepted the disappearance of our republic. That's why I ask, what is to be done about this as newspapers fold all over the country, et cetera, et cetera? I'm done now. But
all right. Thanks, Rich. Thanks for the call. What is to be done about this?
Well, first of all, let's not exaggerate things. There was a real reason to be afraid of the Soviet Union, and especially when they got the bomb and when they got the hydrogen bomb. So that's the original source of fear was justified. The exploitation of it for ancillary uses by the government is what's so bad. It's the same with terrorism now. That's a legitimate fear, but the way to respond to it is not to treat terrorism as a country, whether Iraq or Afghanistan, and invade the country. Terrorism has metastasized. It's not a country. We get terrorist attacks launched from London now. So the intelligent way to go after it is to cooperate with all the intelligence agencies that are friendly to us around the world and track down the terrorists wherever they are, but not launch an outright war. You know, not what we have done now is pour into Afghanistan tremendous amounts of money and resources and men and women, and that paralyzes us for reacting elsewhere in the matter. And they're given a Sisyphean task to put together a country that was not really a country, that's corrupt through and through, that's based on a drug economy, and try to build stability there. That's no way to fight terrorism. That's hitting ourselves in the head and saying that proves how tough we are.
What? Thanks, Rich, very much for the call. We'll take more calls in a moment. When we think about wars, about recent wars, Korea was, as you cite in your book, thought of as Truman's war. Vietnam was thought of as Johnson's war and Nixon's war, and Iraq, of course, Bush's war, and now Afghanistan, Obama's war. Why is it that we as a society, and the consequences of all of this has been, a lot of people have been killed as a result of this, in American soldiers and people in Korea and Vietnam and in Iraq. Why is it that either Congress or the American public hasn't really debated this issue of who should have the authority, how much of this needs to be very transparent, that which is not a threat to the United States? Why haven't we changed our course considering the consequences?
Well, that's one of the problems with secrecy. We can't debate it when we're excluded from the debate. You know, during Vietnam, Lyndon Johnson said, if you knew what I know,
right,
you would realize that I'm acting very prudently, but you can't know it because you don't have clearance.
Mm-hmm.
So only the priesthood of the secrets can decide this. Let me give another example. The first President Bush asked for support from Congress, not for a declaration of war, but for support to invade Kuwait. The former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Crowe, went before the Senate Intelligence, the Foreign Relations Committee, and said, we haven't really given sanctions a very good test yet. Why don't we continue them for a while and then go to war if we have to? Secretary of State Jim Baker came before the same committee after that and said, Admiral Crowe no longer has clearance. He can't read the cables, so his opinion should not be taken seriously. Well, if his opinion is not taken seriously, nobody is unless they are part of this inner core of people cleared to read the secrets. And Daniel Ellsberg's service, he helped create the Pentagon Papers. And he knew that Johnson didn't have very good information. The Pentagon Papers were full of contradictory, ignorant statements, all kinds of erroneous stuff. So he leaked them. And that showed that the emperor had no clothes. But you couldn't debate it until he did that. He took a very big risk of going to jail to do it. And then we found out that Johnson had no real rationale. Now, the interesting thing is that the leak occurred under President Nixon, and some of the people around Nixon said, don't worry about this. It doesn't touch you at all. All that stuff that's covered was during Johnson's administration. But he had the same reaction that other presidents have. I can't allow the secrets out. I'll want to use this power to preclude discussion from critics and people who would be obstacles. So he had Ellsberg prosecuted, tried to send him to jail, and failed. But that's the reaction in general, that you keep all the secrets. Now, there is a reason for secrecy. You keep secrets from your enemy. If you're going to invade Europe, you don't tell them when and where D-Day is going to occur. But once the invasion occurs, the secret is obsolete and there's no reason to keep it. Now we keep all our secrets, not because we're fooling the enemy. Most of the time we're fooling either Congress or the people. My favorite Doonesbury strip, Gary Trudeau gave me the original to hang on my wall, is of someone going into Cambodia and finding a flattened country all bombed up and a couple standing in front of their ruined house. And he says, the man visiting says, wow, this is historic ground. This is the site of the secret bombing of Cambodia. And the man says, no, it was no secret. I said to Martha, look, there are the bombs falling.
Oh, my.
The secret bombing of Cambodia was meant to be secret from Congress, mm-hmm. so that they wouldn't know that Nixon had started a war with a country we were not at war with and was using money meant for Vietnam in Cambodia. And that's often the case. The real use of secrecy is to fool the Americans or the Congress, not the enemy.
We'll pause for a moment, return, and take more phone calls. Gary Wills is our guest this hour. His latest book is Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gary Wills, our guest, author of Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. Mark from Green Bay, our next caller. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi. Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
Sure.
I'd like you to go a little bit more into the decision to keep Vice President Truman out of the loop and how secrecy could reach up to the top echelon of the government, and what's to keep this multi-generational military from keeping other secrets from our present president?
Well, that's a good question. The idea that only a few know how to handle the secrets, and Truman was not yet trusted do that. A good example of that is this, that in a time of nuclear war, there is fear of decapitation, that is, of the top layer of government being taken out by an attack. And therefore, Congress passed the amendment on presidential succession, that if the vice president are killed, then it would go down to the Speaker of the House and to other people. But during the Reagan administration, people said, well, if we are attacked and the Speaker of the House becomes the one who can control response, he or she won't know the technical aspects. It's a very complicated thing to launch a nuclear weapon. There are a number of safeguards and technical obstacles that have to be overcome. So they set up a secret meeting of staffers from the White House, including Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, who were called at home and sent to an undisclosed location, first use of that term. And they were told not to tell their wives. And they underwent a war game in which they chose whatever surviving cabinet member there was and briefed him on how to launch a nuclear attack. That's outside the Constitution, outside presidential succession laws, outside the chain of military command. And that was a secret arrangement to take the bomb power of the president underground, as it were. And if that failed, the eye in the sky, there was a nuclear laboratory flying constantly, which would take over in case everything on the ground had been knocked out. So all of that bomb power still operates in secret, outside normal, legal, political, military channels.
And Cheney used that, as you write in the book, after September 11th. He used what he learned at that undisclosed location.
That's right. The 9/11 Commission found out that Cheney was told that there were, after the Twin Towers were struck, that there were other planes, plural, up there headed toward targets. And he scrambled Air Force jets to go shoot down the planes. Now, actually, there was only one plane, and it went down because of passenger insurrection. So nothing was shot down. But the order went out from Cheney, and he didn't consult the president. He was in the White House. The president was flying around somewhere. And Scooter Libby, who was standing at his elbow, said he didn't talk to the president before he issued the order, and he hesitated no longer than a batter hesitates when he sees the pitch coming toward him. He did that to boast about Cheney's power. But, of course, that was the secret bomb power that he had been rehearsed to exercise.
Right.
Even though
the president
was not a nuclear attack. You know, technically,
yes,
it should have been exercised only in a nuclear attack. But just as Dean Acheson said, Korea is not a nuclear war, but You have to act as if it were was, Mr. President.
But he, but the president was fully capable of making those kinds of decisions, wasn't he?
Yeah, but Cheney said, we can't even take time to call him because they're flying. We've got to get to them before they hit their targets.
Hmm. Thanks, Mark, for your call. We go to Walt from Fort Atkinson next. Hi, Walt.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen and Professor Wills. This is an interesting topic to me because of the time that I spent working at the Nevada test site some time ago when there was active underground testing. But I had a chance to walk around on Frenchman Flat, Ground Zero, where there had been above-ground testing, and it was such a surreal site that was, you know, there was a bridge out there in the middle of a dry lake that had been mangled by testing and so on. And so over the years, it has occurred to me that the further we get from those examples of the destructive power of these bombs, that I wonder if people, even the president, really appreciates the enormous power and destruction that can be, you know, brought by these things. That's,
yeah, you're
that's
right.
My one question. If I could ask one other one quick,
okay.
That's equally important to me. A few years ago, there was a report of a couple bombs that were loaded, and I think they were active or, you know, ready-to-go bombs that were loaded on an airplane and flown from, like, North Dakota to Texas. And my experience tells me that was no accident, not with the security and all the people that would have to be involved. That I wonder if you can tell me what was going on with that.
Well, first of all, we have so many bombs now in foreign countries and elsewhere and down in submarines. There's always the possibility that a submarine will go down and will be recovered by some enemy. But when you're talking about the testing, they didn't test the hydrogen bomb above ground in American soil. They had taken over Bikini Island and the atolls over there and just extruded the natives. And they tested them there. Now, the hydrogen bomb is 80 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. And so its destructive force is what Oppenheimer called genocidal. It would kill so many people indiscriminately, men, women, and children, that to use it is immoral on the face of it, and there was no reason to develop something that you couldn't use. And it was not a deterrent to Russia when it got a hydrogen bomb, because you can kill a lot of people with atom bombs. You don't have to kill whole countries with hydrogen bombs.
Thank you very much, Walt, for your call. Let's go next to Rick from Milwaukee. Hi, Rick.
Morning. I wanted to return to some of the things Professor Wills was talking about at the top of the program about very potential threatening threats to our liberty from the national security state. He mentioned, for example, plan to draft strikers if they if was it railroad strikers?
Yeah.
There were a lot of things like that going on way back then, and I would assume there are things in the works now similarly. One of the things back at that time, as I recall, was the McCarran Act, which set up prison camps across the United States where citizens who were politically active in some kind of form of dissent were put on lists, various lists. One was a rabble-rouser list, another a national security list, and the last one I heard of was the administrative list, which went way into the 1970s, that in a case of a, quote, national emergency, thousands of Americans would be rounded up and put in these camps. And I don't know if the average American, the average person on the street, knows that these kind of potentials develop in a national security state.
Yeah, the FBI did have those lists. And like most of these secret things, including the Pentagon Papers, they were based on rumor, speculation, error. Dorothy Day, the great pacifist moral leader, was on one of the lists. She would have to be interned as a threat to the country. And then they found out they had mistaken her for Baroness Heck, another...
Oh, my goodness.
Another Catholic peace advocate. So The trouble with secrecy is that correction is very hard because the people who could correct it have no access. Senator Moynihan said that's why we get such bad policy, because good policy depends on an open criticism and contribution by people who are knowledgeable. And he gives as an example of that the Bay of Pigs. The premise of the Bay of Pigs is you could have put a few Cubans ashore and they would provoke a rebellion against Fidel Castro. Well, Moynihan says Fidel Castro, after the success of his revolution, was riding high in popular support. Academic experts knew that. Journalists down there knew that. Pollsters knew it. And he said, why did President Kennedy not listen to any of those? He said, because their information was not classified. It was open. And so the CIA and the military who went to Kennedy said, we know the secrets. Only we are knowledgeable in this area because only we have clearance to read the secrets.
And you hear from, you know, in years subsequent to that, so many American people will say, well, people have information that we just don't know, and they're willing to accept it, right?
Yeah, right.
It's okay. They know. We don't know.
The president knows best.
Yeah.
Right.
Thanks, Rick, for your call. Luba is next from Madison. Hi, Luba.
Hi. Mr. Wills, I have a question that has bothered me for a long, long, long time. And I heard a speaker say that Truman was going to test the bomb, or one of the sites considered for testing the bomb was Bulgaria. Now, is there any truth to that?
I have no idea. I've never heard that. I don't think he was trying to test the bomb in a foreign country. He was tempted to use it and said it's a weapon that we made and we can use if we want. But all the testing went on, most of it around Bikini Island. You know, that was not a foreign country in a technical sense. I guess it was our protectorate at that point.
Thanks for the call. And I know you've touched on this, but I'd like for you to expand on it just a bit. Did the potential for escalation to Armageddon limit the scope of wars in the post-World War II era?
Well, it limited the scope of all-out war, but it encouraged us to have all these little wars and little secret wars and use people to set up friendly administrations. See, one of the things, if you're deploying these weapons around the world, you want friendly governments to help you protect your secret sites and all your secrets. And so we bumped off people that we thought were not trustworthy. The first example of that was Iran. The Shah of Iran had been overthrown by Mossadegh, who had popular support, and the CIA went in and used a bunch of cat's paws, a lot of them are just street thugs, to promote demonstrations and bring the Shah back. That was a secret war that was run by Eisenhower and his CIA director, Alan Dulles. And it caused us so much trouble. You know, all of our later troubles with Iran come with the fact that we put back in the Shah, and when the people found out what the Americans had done, they resented us and they resented the Shah, and so we got the Ayatollah Khomeini, and we've had all kinds of opposition and hostility ever since. So a lot of these operations backfire, as the Bay of Pigs did, or as our putting up puppets in Vietnam. Then Eisenhower wanted to take over Guatemala. Eisenhower was very sensible in many ways. He did try to reduce arms, nuclear arms. He did try to have peace talks. He did warn against the military-industrial complex. But for the first time, he put two brothers in key roles, John Foster Dulles as Secretary of State and Alan Dulles as CIA head, and they were very urgent about running secret hostile takeovers around the world. So Eisenhower sponsored at least five of these coups, and they almost all had very sad results for us. It's very hard to make a successful secret replacing somebody else's government and get away with it for any length of time.
Right, I would imagine. Well, thank you so much for being with us. I just wanted to talk to you for a moment here about your Wisconsin roots. You went to high school in Wisconsin, right?
That's right, Campion High School, prior to Sheen, Wisconsin.
And so did you grow up there, too?
No, I grew up in Michigan.
Oh,
I went there because the nuns who educated me in Michigan said, we're not as good a school as the Jesuits run, so you better go to a Jesuit school. They were wonderful nuns.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Surely.
Thanks. Our guest this hour, Gary Wills. His book is Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. He has been described this way, that there may not be a historian or a critic in America of greater breadth. The subjects range from George Washington to Jack Ruby, from St. Paul to John Wayne to Ronald Reagan, Pius IX. He's a former Jesuit seminarian, and he has written 41 books now on a number of topics. We thank him so much. The whole idea of this book is the history of America since World War II, caused in transfer of power toward the executive branch. So there's a monopoly on the use of nuclear weaponry, the cult of the commander-in-chief, the worldwide network of military bases to maintain nuclear alert and supremacy, secret intelligence agencies, the entire national security state. So it covers all the presidents since Truman. Thanks to Erica Janik and Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Chrissy Peace for on-air production. We'll be with you tomorrow.